Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to Viet History Makers. I am joined by my co-host, Kevin Pham. Welcome back, Kevin.
It's great to be back.
So today we are talking about Nguyễn Thị Bình, who is actually the granddaughter of Phan Chu Trinh, right?
Phan Chu Trinh was her maternal grandfather.
Oh, so interesting. Again, she's one of these figures where, you know, for me, I'm always very uncomfortable, and I'll be honest, you know, to talk about, because, you know, we're not here to pick sides. We're just here to really break down different lives of people throughout the history of Vietnam. And we want to take the most objective approach. So with that in mind, let's get started.
Good. So why Nguyễn Thị Bình, and who was she really? Well, she is really, really famous for those of you who don't know. And I should say that if you're Vietnamese American, maybe you haven't heard of her. Because she was the chief diplomat on the side of the Vietnamese communists who was leading the delegation for the side of the communists at the Paris Peace Conference in 1973. So on the side of the communists, she's a very big name. She's an important figure. We had talked about the Paris Peace Conference of 1973 in the last episode on Nguyễn Văn Thụ. But if listeners remember, the main negotiators there were Henry Kissinger and Lê Đức Thọ. But Nguyễn Thị Bình was a big figure in those negotiations because the conference, the Paris Peace Conference, was not a one event thing in 1973. It had been going on since 1968 in Paris. Ongoing discussions, almost every week, these diplomats and these negotiators would go there. And in 1973, she was one of the signatories to the conference. Now, we should keep in mind that the North and the South, or the communist Vietnamese and the anti-communist Vietnamese, they immediately break the agreements, and they frequently break them. I mean, the talks really went nowhere. But these were important times here. Now, the conference were... There were four participants, essentially. It was the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which is North Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, which is South Vietnam, and then the United States of America, and importantly, the Provisional Revolutionary Government of South Vietnam. So, Chính phủ Cách mạng Lâm thời Cộng hòa miền Nam Việt Nam. So, this was a government created in 1969, and it's a government in the South opposing Nguyễn Văn Thụ. This is the Viet Cong, what the anti-communists call the Viet Cong. They are the communists, so they represent the Southern communists. But they're separate from the DRV in the North and the RVN in the South. So Nguyễn Thị Bình was the Minister of Foreign Affairs of this Southern communist government the entire time it existed, from 1969 to 1976.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You know, that is a lot of research for you. I mean, this is not part of the six figures that you do for your book. It sounds like there's a lot of work and a lot of research that you put in. And I always want to remind our audience in the beginning, the level of detail that you really put into it. So tell us how our audience can help contribute to the time that you put in at the coffee shop.
Thanks, Ken, for the donation call. Listener, if you appreciate these, please know that I craft these episodes as I work in a cafe. So feel free to buy me a coffee. It'll mean a lot. You can do that with a super thanks on YouTube. If you just go to the comment section, you can buy a super thanks.
Now, before we get into this, you know, we are going into really the accomplishments of a woman on the communist side, you know, and oftentimes when I'm reading the comments, you know, we get, you know, really supportive commentary, but there's also this sort of like, why are you highlighting somebody on the other side, you know? And I think it's fair to kind of, I want to hear your thoughts, remind us why, you know, it's important to talk about both sides of these governments. It's multifaceted. There's so many different parties, but why do we choose to talk about something that's so painful for our family side?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was born in 1988. I have no memory of the war. I didn't live through it. I grew up in San Jose in California, and I love my family. I love the Vietnamese community here. When I grew up, I also had friends who were very leftists and who called themselves Marxists. And I was curious about Vietnamese Marxism. And so that's why when I graduated from UC Irvine in 2010, I decided to move to Vietnam to learn about the country my parents left. And I remember meeting young people my age there whose families were on the other side. And I remember being scared at first because I was on the motorbike with them and we were heading into the village and I said, were they on the communist side? And then I remember she laughed and she said, yes, of course. And I said, but I'm scared. Are they going to hate me? And when I got there, they know my background. I told them who I was and we laughed, drank beer and shook hands. And to me, it was a beautiful thing. And I realized that older people, maybe people who remember the war, they might feel differently, but I personally feel happy and eager to examine the lives and perspectives of all Vietnamese people, no matter what side they were on. So that's, I can only speak for myself there.
Yeah. And I think that's a great answer. But I also want to add, for me, this woman is important just so we can explore how she empowered women in Vietnam. I mean, that's something that, you know, she rose to the highest ranks of political history in Vietnam, and she became the vice president, and she did a lot for women's rights, women's reforms. So I think all in all, you know, this is, you know, something that she did good for the women of Vietnam. And I think it's important that we really discuss that angle and spotlight that, if anything. I mean, obviously you're going to get into a lot more, but for me, this woman really, you know, I think that's very innovative for somebody of her time.
Absolutely. And we'll talk more about that. I mean, she is, so one thing I should start off by saying is that she has a memoir that anyone who can read Vietnamese can find online. It's called Gia Đình Bạn Bè, Đất Nước, Hội Ký. So it's Family, Friends, and Country. And you can just type that into Google, look for the PDF. And what's fascinating is that in the introduction, there's a writer who introduced Nguyen Thi Binh, and the writer said, and I'm going to quote the writer is Nguyen Ngoc, "It can be said without fear that she's probably the Vietnamese person with the most friends in the world. During those years, she was present almost everywhere on the planet. And strangely, beautifully, the image of a fiercely fighting Vietnam was represented not by a warrior full of murderous intent, but by a petite, humble, yet learned woman, approachable yet elegant, whose unshakable steadfastness was expressed by a leisurely and confident appearance." So she was the image of Vietnam for the world. During these negotiations and in her image, I mean, she's speaking fluent French. I can speak and understand French. So for this episode, I was watching a few YouTube videos of her speaking in French, being interviewed in French. And she's a very smart woman, very clear, very sharp, and very admirable. And if you look in the comments, all these Vietnamese people are saying, wow, what a talented woman. And one thing that I should mention here is that she was hugely popular, not just in Vietnam, but outside, especially for young people in the United States and in Europe who were critical of the Americans. I mean, they were siding with the communists here. And so, for example, what I found interesting was that she, and if I could find this in my notes here, she was the... There was an organization in the United States called the May 19 Communist Organization. And this was a group of far left young people in the United States. I mean, they were called terrorists, right? And their organization was called May 19 because May 19 is supposedly the birthday of Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X. And their propaganda unit was called Madame Binh Graphics Collective. Mm. And this existed from 1977 to 1983, and it was an all-women collective in the U.S. dedicated to anti-racist, anti-imperialist projects. So she is inspiring people all over the world here.
All right. Well, I have to ask a question that is on my mind as you're bringing up this, these dates, these years, and we can't not move forward without asking. You might not have the answers for this, but this is something that I want the audience to know that I'm thinking about as I'm being sensitive to my family side, your family side. In those years, that would be the height of the re-education camps of the officers of the South. Where was she as a potential, you know, female figure, a woman who I'm not sure if she was a mother or not, but to understand and put the touch of a mother thinking about, you know, sons and fathers of the South being locked up, did she have a voice? Did she ever talk about the re-education camps? Because that I understand was something that was, you know, not everybody in the communist government agreed with the re-education camps. And did she ever voice her disdain or, you know, her unhappy position that these men were being locked up and treated a certain way?
Well, this is a really good question because right after the war, so starting in 1976, her new job was Minister of Education in Vietnam. Mm. And she had that position until 1987. So she switched to the education field because she was a teacher before. I mean, she was good at subjects like math and she tutored students. And so after returning home from her diplomacy, her comrades asked her to become Minister of Education. They said, "You've already worked as a teacher, so you can do education." Now, to the topic of re-education camps, I don't know, actually. I think that's a really interesting question, and I would love it if somebody knows. I will look that up later, but for now, I don't know. And actually, I will investigate after this episode because that's such an interesting question. But this reminds me, I think we should now go we should now go through the events of her life here. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, let's jump into this. So, her paternal grandfather, not her maternal grandfather, but her paternal grandfather was a soldier in the Ganvung movement. So this was a movement in the late 1800s where scholar gentry in Vietnam called upon the Vietnamese to resist the French in order to save the king. That's why it's called the Save the King movement. And her maternal grandfather is Phan Chu Chen. So the point here is that she was raised in a family that had deep patriotic roots. And she's going to emphasize this in her memoir. So I've been reading her memoir. And she says, everybody in Vietnam agrees that Phan Chu Chen, my grandfather, introduced democracy and civil rights to Vietnam. I was born and raised in this environment of freedom and liberty. And so, okay, so she's born in Quang Nam, which is a province in central Vietnam. It's near Hoi An. And what's interesting is that she studied in a school in Cambodia when she was younger. So she studied French there. And that was in Phnom Penh. In 1945, her father goes to the war zone. So listeners should know that the first Indochina war is between 1945, 46 to 1954, Viet Minh against the French. So she works for the Viet Minh, but she had an alias here. So her name was Yen Sa. And during these war times, she engaged in famine relief. She participated in the seizure of power during the August Revolution around the country. She transported weapons to the war zone. And around this time, she says her mother died and her father said to her, you should try to study hard because you have five younger siblings who need your help. And if you study well, then you can have a position in society. And so she always had that in her mind that she needs to study. And her father said, if I die, then you're going to have to take care of your younger siblings. So she dreamed at the time of becoming a doctor because her mother was sick and it was hard to find doctors. And so she thought, well, this country needs doctors. So she had planned to study to become a doctor. But when the 1945 August Revolution breaks out, everyone follows the revolution. They follow the resistance. And so she also decides to join the resistance. And then at this time, she starts learning about things that she didn't know. So these are the ideas of the revolution, of the communist revolution. So she's learning about Marxism, Leninism. So she says, I borrowed a few books for it. So you can imagine, you know, she's asking, hey, give me some books. And she says, it was hard for me to understand them at the time. But through conversations with people who were coming back from the war zone, I could learn more and more. And so she says, I was learning about dialectical materialism, and eventually my political level improves. And at the age of 20, I was the secretary of the Party Committee of the Women's National Salvation Union of Saigon. So it's a women's organization in Saigon. So she becomes president of this organization. So this is around 1946, 1947. When she's learning about ideology. In 1948, this is just a few years after she's being exposed to these political ideas, she is asked to join the Communist Party. And so she says, I remember in her memoir, she said to the person, let me think about it. And then she quickly says, okay, yeah, I'll join. Like, you know, this is revolution here. And so one of her first tasks was to mobilize bourgeois intellectual women to get them onto the side of the communists. And so she said, for me, I'm quoting her, for me, this was a difficult task. The sisters were used to a free and comfortable lifestyle and could not be confined to a tight framework of activities. But after a time, they eventually agreed to join the Progressive Women's Organization. This is really interesting about thinking about privileged women living in Saigon. This is where she is, you know. As you had mentioned in the last episode, you know, Saigon is kind of a nice, flourishing place materially. How do you get people who are comfortable to leave and to join resistance, you know?
Yeah, that's a what a tactic. This is going to be interesting because, I think that she's coming from a place of trying to change the hearts and minds of people. But, you know, if you're living in comfort, you don't think about these things.
Right. And if listeners are interested, actually, I published an article about looking at oral history narratives of Vietnamese women in the 1950s who decide to leave their comforts to join the Maquis, the resistance in the jungle. And one argument I promote is that all of them say that they were motivated by theater, by being an audience member to theater. Yeah, like either they were watching a film or they were listening to stories that their parents would tell them or stories of Vietnamese resisting the Chinese. Anyway, this is kind of off topic, but not really. But the point here is that in the 1950s, the early 1950s, a lot of young women left their comfortable lives to go to the resistance in the jungle.
Oh,
anyway, so yeah, in 1951, Nguyen Thi Binh is arrested by the enemy, and this is either the French or the Vietnamese who are working with the French, and she's imprisoned, and she's released from prison in 1954. And right after that, in 1955, she goes north to receive more training. In 1956, she has a child, and she has another child in 1960. And this is really fascinating to read about in her memoir, because she's going to talk about how she had to leave them, her own children, to do what the party wants her to do. So her children's names are Tang and Mai. And so she writes about how during these times of war, you have to sacrifice, you have to do what the state asks of you. So in 1960, this is the birth of the what we would call the Viet Cong, or the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. This is the birth of that organization. And so she is someone with good French-speaking skills. She can speak very good French. And so, and she is someone who participated in these activities, anti-French activities. She had experience in mobilizing people and engaging in propaganda. And so it seems very natural that the central committee of the Viet Cong, they appoint her to join the committee. So now this is when she becomes known as Nguyen Thi Binh. So she becomes, at this time, she's working for the Viet Cong. And then now I want to talk about 1968. 1968 is a very bloody year. And this is also the beginning of Paris peace talks. And so she's chosen to be the head of this delegation to attend this four-party conference in Paris. And she is the Minister of Foreign Affairs, as I had said, of the Provisional Revolutionary Government of South Vietnam. So she says, and I'm going to quote her, she says, "Because I had a certain level of education and knew French, my English was still broken at that time, but thanks to the French, I was very successful in my work. At the time, the revolution needed a person with political courage, cultural and foreign language qualifications to do foreign affairs, and I was chosen to be the head of the negotiating delegation of the Paris Conference. Not long after, I became the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Provisional Revolutionary Government of the Republic of South Vietnam. And at that time, I was only 41 years old, but I could do the requirements of the job. I was young, but I was confident I could do it. In fact, I always had the awareness to study and to set tasks for myself. Today, I must do better than yesterday." And so she said also, quote, "In the extremely fierce struggle between a small nation against a large empire, leading the negotiating delegation was a female delegate, me, which not only attracted attention, but also won the sympathy of world public opinion, creating more favorable conditions for foreign affairs activities." So here we can almost see that this was almost maybe partly even strategic on the part of the communist side to have her. I mean, to have a woman representing the communist side.
Yeah. And she sounds so aware of her power, of her qualifications and her voice as a woman.
Right. And there was a woman journalist named Madeleine Riffaut, and she wrote about Nguyen Thi Binh and said, quote, "The Viet Cong had a great victory through the reception of Mrs. Binh in Paris. Mrs. Binh was like a queen, welcomed like a head of state with all the proper formalities. Mrs. Binh shocked public opinion in Paris and the world. The flag of the National Front was flying in Paris." Very wonderful, very rare. Like, wow, right?
Yeah.
As
somebody who is, you know, I grew up fairly ignorant of the other side, quote unquote. And just to think that they were, you know, at the table negotiating, they had this queen-like figure way before we were born or, you know, understood anything about politics. They had a sophistication in this woman who spoke fluent French. And you realize like the apparatus of this group was far more, there's far more thought out than, you know, as I was growing up thinking about the communists, because I just thought these guys were in black PJs, pajamas, you know, fighting in the jungle. And they were just kind of creeping up every moment and inching it, you know, into the cities of South Vietnam. But instead, you know, many of that is the opposite of what we, as a child, what I thought. I just thought that it was like just a bunch of, you know, AK-47 holding, you know, guys in the jungle creeping up. But there's a sophistication to the thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we had mentioned in our last episode, too, that when Nguyen Van Thieu is calling for more and more weapons, the communist side, they are well funded by the Soviet Union and China. Ever since 1949, since the Chinese won their civil war, right? They're getting support from these big powers here. So Madame Binh, as they used to call her, I mean, she is elegant and almost, she's wearing an ao yai, right? And a suit jacket. And sometimes she has a fur collar. And she's going to this conference house in Paris, always talking to the press, giving interviews. I mean, listeners can watch this. And so image plays a role here. One other thing, so I'm kind of just going through the bio here, but in the war ends in 1975. So in 1976, Nguyen Thi Binh is appointed, as I had mentioned, the Minister of Education. And then she holds that position until 1987. And then in 1992, she is elected vice president. And this is a very big position. She's vice president of what's officially called the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. And so she holds this position for 10 years, and that's two terms. And so what I found interesting here was that I was looking at some of her speeches. And so according to her, you know, she's going to say things like, "Women must have a spirit of progress. Women who do not progress themselves, that's not good. Like, you need to have a spirit of progress." So she says there are some successful women because they have a spirit of progress. In my opinion, first of all, one must have a cultural level of cultural understanding, basic knowledge, but you also must be a professional. So she's going to talk about how Vietnamese culture needs to be promoted, but also women must have a career that truly contributes to society. So she says women sometimes cannot avoid the duty of being a mother, but that's the challenge for women. It's good to be mothers, but they also need to have a career to contribute to society. So she's going to emphasize this double burden of women. Yeah. Another thing I found interesting was that when she was asked if she had any regrets in her youth, she said, "If you're a self-respecting person, you must always know how to self-criticize." And again, I mean, I'm just stepping back here remember Ho Chi Minh, he was always saying this, you need to engage in criticism and self-criticism. That's the most important thing any communist revolutionary could do. So she says, there are things that should be done better, but your level is limited, or because of the circumstances, you could not do better. So she said, as she criticized herself, and she said, if only during my negotiations in Paris, my English was as good as my French, then I could have done more, she says. So she regrets not learning English to use. And she says, later, when I was Minister of Education, there were shortcomings at that time. My level was limited, and the direction was not as adequate. So she didn't go into more detail there, but she thinks that she could have done more at the time.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Well, you know, what's interesting is 92, when she ascended as vice president, this is interesting because shortly after that, the United States began negotiating with Vietnam. This is the time John McCain, President Clinton, were beginning to sort of sit down at the table so they can lift the embargo around 94, 95. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that period of not knowing English kind of left her perhaps outside of the conversation.
Yeah, that's a good point. Oh my gosh, I can't believe we didn't mention this, but she is still alive, right, listener? I mean, she was born in 1927. I hope I said that. But she was born in 1927, and she's still alive here. So, at least I think so. But yeah, she is, I mean, how old was that make her today? How old does that make her
today? No, it's almost 100.
90.
Shoot, 98.
Yeah, she's 98. And another interesting thing I found online was a speech or an essay that she wrote called Vai Suy Ve Xây Dựng Đảng. And so thoughts on how we can build the Communist Party. And this was written in 2017. So I think this is very interesting. So in the speech that she gives, she's essentially laying out the problems that she thinks Vietnam is facing and the solutions. So the problems are ineffective investment, low economic growth, low competitiveness, a budget deficit, high public debt. So these are issues with Vietnam's development, economic development. This is 2017 here. And her solution, she says, how can we address these issues? She's really focused on what the state can do. And she's going to say the state needs to rectify itself, its institutions, so that it can more effectively serve the people. So she names a few what she calls serious evils. One of them is corruption. So she's going to talk about how corrupt cadres need to be removed. And these are cadres who are degraded in ideology. They don't have the right ideology, Marxism, Leninism. So They don't have political qualities. They don't have good ethics. And they have a lifestyle that is not conducive to this. So she's very critical of that. And by the way, just to summarize it all, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think like, wow, she's just repeating what Ho Chi Minh was saying. And she's essentially saying, Ho Chi Minh laid out all these good ideals for the cadres of the party. And the problem is simply not following through on it. And in our episode on Ho Chi Minh, this is a very Confucian model of governance, where a very Leninist one too. Confucianism and Leninism are perfectly compatible here, because the model is that the party is meant to serve the people. So it's rule for the people, but not rule by the people. The people are the masters. The party are the servants. But the party is ruling in the name of the people and doing what's best for the people. And at no point should the people tell the party how to rule, right? But the party is always serving the people. So anyway, so she says, so we need to remove corrupt cadres. We also need to industrialize and modernize. So we need to put an emphasis in education, in science and technology. And so she says, for a long time, the leaders have said the party leads, the state manages, the people are the masters. Yes, that's a good slogan, but up to now, it has not been institutionalized. And there's no document clearly regulating this leadership method. So essentially, she says, we need to really carry that out. One other criticism she makes of the Communist Party is that they're too focused on the quantity, not the quality. So she says, quote, in our cadre policy, there are loopholes that allow many bad people, opportunists, to find ways to join the party, to enter the leadership or management agencies of the party and the state. Therefore, the policy on party development needs to be reviewed and corrected. So don't just let anyone in here.
Well, these are pretty bold initiatives, if you think about it. And I think that I think about what kind of retribution she must have, you know, because when you're in a machine where, especially in Asia, where there's so much corruption, and it's just part of, you know, it's just part of the life that you live in that part of the world. There's just so much corruption. And as a lone voice, and you stand up against the way things work, I wonder, you know, how much courage that took for her to really speak out against this stuff.
Well, I mean, I think at this point she's very, very well respected, right? And yeah, going against corruption
capital.
The whole point of going against corruption is what Ho Chi Minh was always saying. You know, you need to purify yourself through criticism and self-criticism. It's very Maoist, and they get it from Stalin, but it's this constant process, according to them, by which you purify yourself. And so it was interesting to read it through her speech here and to see her call for that. I mean, I can't help but compare that to other nations and how they might want to resolve their problems. You know, like countries like the United States would probably say, what we need is less government, you know, not more. But here she's saying, no, we need to strengthen the government, but also weed out corruption and things like that.
But, you know, corruption is an age-old problem in Vietnam. There was a lot of corruption in the South government. And then we're finding out that there's a lot of corruption in the North. It's culturally embedded, I think, not just in Vietnam, but all over Asia, Southeast Asia. It is a problem. And I think that, you know, we just have to recognize that this exists everywhere. It exists in all times. And I think that I bring that up because many people in Vietnamese American society says, oh, I'm not going to go back to Vietnam. It's so corrupt. Well, it's always been corrupt. You know, I think the key is, how do you get the corruption? And this is probably not a question and answer for today, but it's also something that I always, you know, think about it. It exists in our culture. So whether you're in the South Vietnamese government pre-75 or after, there's all these levels of corruption. And I think that happens, you know, maybe more, you know, in today in Vietnam that was happening less in South Vietnam pre-75 for our parents. But I don't know if you can weed it out. You know, it's everywhere.
Well, I, from my what I experienced, I mean, I used to, in 2011, I used to put a $20 in my passport, yep. You know, going through customs, because my boss told me to do that. I didn't know to do that. He said, you want to get through easier, do that. Nobody does that today.
Nope.
So there's less bribery there. Right. And even when I was just in Vietnam a few weeks ago, I wasn't even sure about how to cross the street anymore. I mean, back in the day, you would just walk as traffic's going, but now people follow the street lights and you get fined if you don't. And so it's always a struggle, you know, it's always a struggle to, and you know, I think this might be appropriate to talk about here, because we're talking about Nguyễn Thị Binh, who avows communism and dialectical materialism. So one thing that I want to say here in this discussion of, is Vietnam corrupt or is Vietnam communist or is Vietnam capitalist? What I want to suggest is that according to a Marxist perspective, these are the wrong questions to ask. It's always a bad question if it's a binary, if it's a yes or a no. Is Vietnam communist or capitalist? Is it corrupt or not corrupt? The right answer is that, well, it's always a struggle between the aspirations of a people and the material conditions that they live in. So if you want to know if Vietnam's communist or not, like some people might look at Vietnam today and say, oh, they've abandoned communism. Look at it. It's so capitalist, right? But if you go to Vietnam today and you talk to some people, you ask them, did you abandon communism? Some people are going to tell you, no, we're at a stage where we're going through capitalism and then we're going to get to communism. If you read Marx and Engels, you have to go through the capitalist stage before you can get to the stage of communism. It's a struggle. It's a process, right? So is Vietnam corrupt? Well, some people would say we're struggling to get rid of corruption, right? It's a constant struggle and it never ends. It's always a dialectical struggle between contradictions. It's like Mao Zedong gave the example of what is dialectical materialism or dialectics? And he gave the example, it's, for example, when you're studying, when you're reading a book about something you don't know, like let's say I pick up a book about astronomy. I don't know anything about astronomy. So I have ignorance about astronomy in my mind. But the more I read a book about astronomy, I'm struggling between my ignorance and the knowledge of the book. And then I'm becoming more knowledgeable about astronomy. That is how change happens, according to Marxists. It's through internal contradictions and struggles. And so that's how I think they would respond to the question of, is Vietnam corrupt or not? Is it communist or capitalist? They would say, we're always struggling. Now, it's true that there are going to be forces that are against the communist struggle, but again, it's a struggle.
But I also think that all these things, yeah, makes sense. But I also think that all of these things can exist at the same time in different degrees, right? I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think that capitalism can exist within a communist framework. And I think corruption can be in different degrees, in heavy degrees in a government. And I just think, depending on who the administration or administrators are, you know, like I think Tô Lâm is the new prime minister, right? And he comes from a police background. And I think he's trying to clean up all the corruption that's happening. He's not tolerating any sort of shenanigans. That's what I'm hearing, you know, word on the street, that he's really cracking down on and, you know, and ironically, it's affecting business because nobody wants to stick their neck out to do loans or to kind of like finance projects in within the government. So it's a problem that's stifling economy, economics in Vietnam right now. So it's such an interesting time in Vietnam.
Right, right. One thing about socialism, like if you want to know, is this country heading towards socialism or is it not? You can ask yourself two questions. first might be, well, is there a redistribution of wealth? To what? How much wealth is distributed among its people? Like, in other words, how much inequality is there, right? That's one question. Another is, who owns the means of production? Are they collectively owned or are they privately owned, right? And so we can try to answer the question of, oh, is it moving towards socialism or is it socialist or is it not, with those questions. Now, in Vietnam, yes, there's private enterprise, but ultimately the government owns a lot of this stuff, right? Ultimately, you need to have the okay through the government. And if the government claims to speak for the people, then leave it to that extent, you could call it socialist. But anyway.
What do you think the fingerprints, what did she leave? What kind of imprints do you think Nguyen Thi Binh has left on women's lives in Vietnam today?
There's a great museum in Hanoi, the Women's Museum. It's a fascinating museum because, on the one hand, it shows the different women who have participated and contributed to the Vietnamese Revolution. It was interesting for me to be in this museum and then to ask the women who I was with what they thought of it. And I was traveling with Americans and I was taking them to all around Vietnam. And these are young women in our group. And I asked them, what did you think? And on the one hand, they said they were inspired and that it was beautiful. But on the other hand, they said something interesting, which was that they said they felt a bit uncomfortable because they felt like women were just being used for a political purpose. I thought that was interesting. Like some felt as if the state was simply just co-opting women and using it for a cause, and that this was in some sense diminishing their own agency, I guess. But if you read the memoir of Nguyen Thi Binh, she is going to say, well, this was all me, you know, like I wanted to do it. No one was using me. People did ask me to join these committees and things, but I wanted to because I wanted to fight for the freedom of my country. I mean, what do you make of that, Ken?
As an individual, she probably holds that belief, and might her conviction really led her internal sort of capacity. But I don't know if, you know, the opposite, you know, saying that the state did not use her is true, because the state and the government, I mean, anytime you have a bunch of guys and men and you have patriarchy, they're gonna exploit. I mean, we're human beings. We're gonna exploit something or someone who we think can do the job. So I think, again, you know, in these nuanced discussions, I think both can be true. One thing that can be very true is that she had this internal belief that she made the choice, which is true. But the other side is true too. A majority of these guys, these men, were there to kind of like use her as well. And I think, you know, the modern woman looking back in time and that we're visiting with you at this museum, these Vietnamese women, I think that they are right too. I don't think that you can exclude these points of view.
It makes me realize maybe one way of putting it is what Rousseau would have liked to see. So Rousseau is famous for saying, well, the challenge is to get your private will to match up with the general will. It's like we all have private interests, and the whole goal is to make our private interests match with the interests of the state, right? And so that's what we see here. We see her wanting to go to war to fight the French and to fight the anti-communists who they see as traitors, and that happened to match with the interests of the state. So there's a matching there. One interesting thing that I found reading through these memoirs is that if we think of Vietnam as a patriarchal society, as a very Confucian society, I mean, Confucius talks about the five relationships, you know, the husband and the wife and the subject, the ruler and the subject, and so on and so on. I mean, these are hierarchical relationships. These are patriarchal relationships. But one thing that women like Nguyen Thi Binh and also Nguyen Thi Dinh, for example, seem to do is that they interpret these traditions in new ways. They interpret these, what you might call a patriarchal tradition, into a progressive one. So they're going to say, well, my love for my family is now my love for my country. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like my duty as a woman is supposed to be to care after my family and my children. Well, now I see my family and my children as all the Vietnamese. You know, they make it revolutionary. They take something that is, you could see it as conservative, and they make it revolutionary. Like even the stories of the Hai Ba Chung, for example, one might say, well, the women, one of the women, they fight the Chinese in order to avenge their husband.
Right.
Like that's one interpretation, right? Right, but then you could say, no, well, it's for patriotism. There are all these sorts of stories that you can kind of reinterpret. And I think of Nguyen Thi Dinh, who we talked about in our earlier episode, how she says, I don't want to get married. I want to join the revolution. But Nguyen Thi Binh and her, I mean, they find ways to combine these traditional expectations of women with revolutionary ones.
You know, we're going to tip the scale back to the South government, hopefully, with another woman in line. Perhaps, and you and I have spoken about this, but I want to tease out the next episode, and perhaps we can look at Madame Nguyen for the next episode, if that's okay with you.
Why not? Jai Lun, as we say.
Jai Lun. Jai Lun, yes. I think that's a figure. Madame Nguyen is a figure that was controversial. And, you know, some people, like I'm in my mom's lineage, think that she did a lot of good and bad for the people. And I think I'd love to hear sort of a breakdown of her life and her involvement with politics of her era.
I think I'll say this, which is that I was having a conversation with my dad. You know, I was just in San Jose with my dad, and he's not going to hide the fact that he is not a fan of Nguyen Van Thieu. He's also not a fan of Nguyen Cao Ky. He sees Southern leaders as weak and corrupt. And when we did the episodes on Ngo Dinh Diem and Nguyen Van Thieu, and when I had mentioned Nguyen Cao Ky, he got upset because he thinks essentially that I'm not representing the South in a good light, or at least we are. And so he told me, why don't we do episodes on noble anti-communist people, such as any of the generals who committed suicide in the South on April 30, 1975, you know, these are figures who fought to the very end. They were not cowards. And so one thing, as I think about when we do these episodes, is the kind of balance. And yeah. I mean, all I know of Madame Nguyen is that she was not likable, according to some. So if we do so,
oh, no.
Unlikable figures, you know what I mean?
I think that's a good point. And I thought about that too when I opened up my mouth, but I was like, all right, there's got to be some salvageable points about Madame Nguyen, perhaps. But I worry about the balance of our perspective. And I think that going into the generals and the brave men who fought to the end I think it'll balance out the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to either, and we can we'll get to them eventually, no matter in what order. But I just wanted
Wonderful.
To raise those thoughts of mine.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Kevin. Thank you so much for today, and we will get back to Viet History Makers in the next episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.